This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J. M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. Your host is Peter Burley.
Coming up on this week's Environment Show, Mexican Environmental Minister Carabias says U.S. corporations no longer relocate to Mexico to avoid environmental laws. 6 million people visit Brooklyn's Prospect Park each year. After 125 years of intense use, the park is showing its age, but an ambitious renovation project hopes to bring it back. Hummingbirds buzz around author Sue Ellen Campbell at her home in Colorado. And in the Earth calendar, the Sun Dagger strikes the rocks at Chaco Canyon, New Mexico. These stories and more coming up on this week's Environment Show. The expression that pollution does not respect political boundaries has become a cliché, but pollution increasingly is a factor in international relations, particularly with respect to the United States and Mexico. When the North American Free Trade Agreement, known as NAFTA, was signed between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada, an environmental side agreement was incorporated in the treaty. It established an International Council of Environmental Cooperation to deal with environmental issues affecting the three countries. Since NAFTA was signed 3 years ago, Mexico has enacted a new comprehensive law for the environment. Nevertheless, Americans have been concerned that U.S. corporations flee to Mexico because environmental regulations are not as strict. I asked Julia Carabias about this when she attended the meeting of the council last week. Julia Carabias is the Minister for the Environment, Natural Resources, and Fisheries of Mexico. A lot of Americans believe, perhaps wrongly, that one of the impacts of freer trade in NAFTA is that American corporations flee to Mexico because there is less environmental restriction. What do you say to people who make that accusation?
Well, first, that was an hypothesis at the beginning, and fortunately, there has been no possibility of demonstrating that hypothesis. We haven't had any situation at all that industries or firms from Canada or the States have moved to our country because of a lower legislation. Because it's not true that we have a lower legislation. We have a legislation which, in the problems that we have, are as strong as the other ones, and we sometimes have some standards which are not equally to the States and Canada, because those are not contaminants that are of the same importance for us.
Minister Carabias is optimistic about progress being made on some of Mexico's toughest environmental problems.
Mexico City is a place which has received a lot of publicity because of the air quality problems in that vast city. Is there any strategy or hope of improving air quality in Mexico City?
Yes, I'm absolutely sure that in the next years we're going to have a much better air in Mexico City. We have a program now, a program that it was presented last year by President Zedillo, and it's a program that has four main activities. Is a cleaner industry, cleaner vehicles, reordery of the city, and restoration of the surroundings with new technologies, with better combustibles, with economical incentives. So with this matrix of variables, we can assure that in the next years we are going to be in a better quality of the two main contaminants that are now the biggest problem, which is ozone and suspended particles. With this effort prolongated, we can be sure that by the year 2010 we can have the quality of air in our cities.
A high priority for Minister Carabias is her program to protect special areas in Mexico. She says Mexico is one of the countries with the most biodiversity in the world, with all ecosystems represented except those of extreme cold. 6% of Mexico is now under special area designation. Her objective is to increase that to 10%.
How's it going? Do people accept this process? I'm sure some of them have real concerns when they see it affecting their own homes or the places that they live.
And especially when there is a lot of commercial interests in that, because in a lot of these areas we have forbidden the cut down of the trees and the projects which are in a high impact. So we have to change those to small impact, like ecotourism and some other possibilities. What we have found is that local people, the inhabitants of these places, that have the tradition of living there, that have the knowledge of the use of their own natural resources, we don't have oppositions with them, and we have a process of together training technologies and getting money for develop those projects, and we are improving with that. What we have more problems is with the external people that is utilizing those resources with a commercial interest, and then we have a confrontation. But in each reserve we are doing the managing plan, which is a document that is a consensus with the inhabitants of what can be done and what cannot be done. Once that we have those management plan, then the things go move better.
That was Julia Carabias, Minister of Environment, Natural Resources and Fisheries of Mexico. She's a cabinet officer in the Zedillo government. In a future Environment Show, we'll examine the work of a Council of Environmental Cooperation, which is intended to better the environment of North America, particularly with respect to those conditions brought about by increased trade between the three North American countries. I'm Peter Burley. $3.2 million people live in Brooklyn, New York, and another 11 million or so live nearby. In this environment, people and concrete can stretch for miles. But green oases do exist, and Prospect Park in Brooklyn is one of these places. 6 million people visit it each year. That's 1.5 million more people than visit the Grand Canyon. Although the park is 125 years old, it still has the ability to enchant. Yet it is being loved to death. It simply cannot support so many people. Now an ambitious project is underway to restore Prospect Park and keep it viable for generations to come. The Environment Show's Thomas Lally has this report.
In the 1800s, city and business leaders in Brooklyn, New York were envious. Central Park in rival Manhattan had just opened, and it was the place to be. So Brooklyn hired Central Park's masterful designer, Frederick Law Olmsted, and Calvert Vaux to design Prospect Park. It, too, was a smashing success. Now, 125 years later, people still flock to the Great Lawn, which stretches for a mile, or to the extensive acreage of woods. Ed Toth is the director of landscape management for the Prospect Park Alliance, a nonprofit group which has formed to aid in the park's recovery. He says Olmsted and Vaux's original idea was to create forest in the city.
Even though it's a very design park, and he clearly put a lot of thought into landscaping and contouring and where to put this tree and that tree, the whole effect was still to be one that you felt like you were in nature, even though it might have been a very engineered experience of nature. He felt very strongly that urban people needed somewhere where they could experience nature, because he felt nature had a profound effect on people. And as he put it, it had a civilizing effect, especially on urban dwellers who had no real exposure to nature.
To accomplish this, Olmsted and Vaux created areas of lawns, waterways, and woodlands. Many areas give the illusion of solitude, even though the bustling city is just a few hundred yards away.
And in places he really went crazy and really went for effect, because he was looking to give people what we might call today an oh-wow experience. You might suddenly turn a bend in the forest and suddenly have a view down a ravine at a waterfall, and it would take your breath away and you would say, isn't nature wonderful?
But the plan wasn't foolproof. Christian Zimmerman is the deputy director of design and construction for the Prospect Park Alliance. He says Olmsted and Vaux underestimated how popular their creation would be and what the impact all those people would have.
There's comments that no sooner did they plant that it was getting trampled down because, you know, remember, this was direct competition with New York City, and that age, you were to be seen. You know, the park drive was a promenade, so, and it went both ways back then. So the carriage concourse, you know, you'd be strolling along and you'd see people and be seen.
And the problems which plagued the park from the beginning have only gotten worse. Soil compaction and erosion have rendered some areas hard as concrete and without any topsoil at all. In these places, few plants can grow, and those that do are often non-native species. Ed Toth says the problem is, very simply, too many people on too small a space.
One of the wonderful things about the park is it's quite possible to have a sense when you're in the park that you're all alone and you're isolated and you're having a wonderful experience, and somehow this piece of pristine nature is yours and yours alone, and that really speaks to the genius of the design. But it's just not the reality, and there have been times when this has been driven home to me, and one of them is if you come out here after a fresh snowfall and you really think you have the place to yourself, and if you do, as I've done, is come look 24 hours after a fresh snowfall, go to the most isolated place in the park and you'll find footprints there.
Restoration won't come easy. Here in a wooded area called the Ambergill, a chain-link fence keeps out visitors, while a backhoe digs out an old pond long since filled with sediment from the surrounding eroded hills. This is one of those oh-wow places. And at one time, the pond emptied over a waterfall. The sound of the water would bounce off the surrounding hills, yet bushes kept the waterfall hidden from view until you got to a stone bridge, when suddenly it came into view. Today, this entire scene is being rebuilt. The old boulders which made up the waterfall were dug up, labeled, and painstakingly put back according to the original plans and photographs. And the hills are being revegetated with thorny plants in hopes of keeping people off them. Ed Toth says he hopes massive projects like this one will turn around the process of destruction.
One of the big problems was that the woods had become so open through time, through loss of understory, that it became easier and easier for people to leave the path system and just start roaming wherever they wanted to. So all the different ecological problems that we identified today, you know, as things that we needed to address, were all different aspects of the degradation that just fed off of each other. Soil compaction, gradually killed off most of the vegetation. As the vegetation killed off more and more, people roamed more, and as they roamed more, the compaction worsened. As the compaction worsened, the erosion worsened. So everything just cycled on itself. So clearly one of our big goals is to revegetate.
Funding for these projects is not cheap. The city is putting up some of the money, and the rest is coming from the Prospect Park Alliance, a private nonprofit group. But Toth says urban parks are not wilderness areas. He says they're more like public gardens that need to be tended.
That's the biggest message here. You know, this doesn't come at no cost. This isn't, you know, the wild. It never will be the wild. And this is a lesson that's going to grow across this country as we, you know, as suburban areas develop and the truly rural disappears. We are the driving force of these ecosystems. And if we want a mountain bike, and if we want to do this and we want to do that, it comes at a price, and so management is important, and that's the real lesson here. These are not things that are going to take, they're living things, they're not going to make it on their own without our intervention.
The genius of Prospect Park is that it is still loved by so many people 125 years after it opened. But by virtue of those millions of visitors, the landscape of Prospect Park is stressed far beyond that which nature can endure. Keeping it green and healthy will take an unending stream of money and patience. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
Joining us now with an update on our listener comments is Stephanie Goishman. Stephanie, I understand that the accusation that greens will make us all reds drew a tremendous reaction.
We were flooded with calls in response to your interview with Holly Swanson. Just to remind our listeners, Swanson wrote a book called Set Up and Sold Out, where she says the green movement, including all the national environmental organizations and other groups like Planned Parenthood and the Children's Defense Fund, use Nazi tactics and are working for takeover of our country by international communism. Here's what some people thought.
Calling to comment on the environmental show, and I just wanted to express my belief that the woman that wrote the book, is absolutely correct. Thank you.
Hello, I was listening to your show. This is George Lewis. I'm from Rolla, Missouri. And you wanted to know if I oppose Green. I very definitely oppose Green. I think they are very much like the Nazi organization of World War II. And that was what your question was. And I do oppose them. I oppose Planned Parenthood. I oppose all of the left-wing things they have. And I will continue to oppose any organization of the Green. Thank you.
But most people thought otherwise.
Regarding the last little gig with Holly Swanson, it's amazing that ignorance is still alive and thriving, evidently. That was incredibly hard to hear, very hard to hear. Thank you, bye.
This is Mrs. Gilbert. I heard the interview with Holly, what's her name, and you said you wanted to know what I thought of it. I think she's just a little bit wild-eyed.
This is Adele Breach. I heard your program on KENW-FM in Portales about 2:35. It ended at 2:40, where Holly Swanson's book was being talked about, and the fact that the Green Movement originated it with Nazi Germany and was communist-backed, and Gorbachev was one of the leaders. And I think that that is a terrible, and somehow we must let it be known that that is a wrong interpretation of what the environmental movement is all about.
Hi, my name is Chris Burke, and I live out in the Berkshire Mountains of Massachusetts. I'd like to address the caller's concern that the environmental movement has parallels with the Nazi movement and the movement towards world communism. The essential characteristic of the Nazi movement was that it was monolithic and absolute in doctrine. In developing, it combined clever appeals of strength and uniformity to a defeated nation, which was suffering titanic economic and social disruption. Coupled with this appeal was a willingness to use intimidation and murder to terrorize those who disagreed. It cannot be disputed that much damage has been done to the earth for many reasons, large and small, including short-sighted self-interest and profit motives. Also, it cannot be disputed that human beings, as living creatures, need a steady supply of clean food, water, and air.
That's all for this week, Peter.
We hope you'll share your comments as well. Tell us what you think. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We all have places which are special to us. For some, they're city streets. For others, they're deep in the wilderness. Sue Ellen Campbell is an author from Colorado. She reads from her book, Bringing the Mountain Home, published by University of Arizona Press. She presents a portrait of lazy summer days and the community of animals in her backyard.
Hummingbirds zip around me, flashing green and purple, copper and vermilion, darting close to check for nectar in my red T-shirt. At first, I flinched when they buzzed past my face, but now I hold my breath to feel the breeze from their wings. This morning, my friend Mary and I startled a peregrine falcon standing on a tall stump. It startled us, too, as it flapped ahead of us down the muddy, cow-trodden trail, past the beaver ponds to a taller tree, then, as we followed, to another. Now we're watching a pair of them circle high against the pale cliffs of volcanic ash, harried by other birds too small from here to name. Their scream is longer than a red-tailed hawk's, high and piercing. We're in low beach chairs, barefoot, settled with binoculars and glasses of wine between the back porch of this old logger's cabin and a clump of willows by the creek. Mary stops speaking mid-sentence, points to our left. Just emerged from the willows is a weasel, nut-brown, dark-pointed face, long tail, pale yellow belly, the essence of sleekness. He stands still and looks at us. In his mouth, he carries a very small, dead mouse, soft and thick like a miniature buffalo robe. We freeze. A curve or two at a time, he moves closer, right past Mary's chair. 3 inches from her foot, he drops the mouse, stands upright, speeds toward my bare feet. Pure reflex. I jump. Squeak. He dashes to one side. We move quickly a few steps to the other. Eyes still on us, he leaps out to the mouse, picks it up, zips under the cabin, vanishes. Amazing. Face to face with a weasel. A peregrine. Hummingbirds. Like subatomic particles, we collide, bounce back, collide again, energies in a vortex, sharing the space. 1 year later, I sit in the same chair, in the same place, writing these pages, and a weasel appears, surely the same one, though now sans mouse. Magic. Again he runs toward my bare feet. This time, I hold still until he's almost to me, wiggle my toes, and he's gone.
Sue Ellen Campbell, reading from her book, Bringing the Mountain Home, published by the University of Arizona Press. Stay tuned. The Earth Calendar is next. Every year at this time, people around the Northern Hemisphere mark the summer solstice, the end of spring and the start of summer. It's the longest day of the year. The Environment Show's Thomas Lally takes us to Chaco Canyon, New Mexico, where an ancient society built markers to the solstice many hundreds of years ago.
At our studios here in Albany, New York, the sun rose this morning at 5:16 a.m. and won't go down till 8:38 tonight. It's the summer solstice, the longest day of the year.
During the summer solstice here in the Northern Hemisphere, the Earth, the Northern Hemisphere of the Earth, is tipped towards the sun. On the winter solstice, the Northern Hemisphere is tipped away from the sun. On the equinoxes, the Northern and the Southern Hemisphere are equal distance from the sun.
G.B. Cornucopia is an interpretive ranger at Chaco Culture National Historic Park in northwestern New Mexico. Chaco is the site of the Sun Dagger on Fajada Butte. Every year, for the week after the solstice, a beam of light enters a 1,000-year-old house at Chaco, once occupied by Anastasi Native Americans. The sunbeam strikes the center of a circle exactly at sunrise. Dabney Ford is the park archaeologist at Chaco.
It's a real quick event. Usually, for instance, up on Fajada Butte, which is the solstice marker, the event takes, actually it takes about an hour. But the time when the dagger of light actually hits the center of the spiral, which marks solstice, is about 10 minutes.
But is the sun dagger something the Anastasi constructed, or is it just a coincidence? That's a hotly debated subject in academic circles these days. Dabney Ford and G.B. Cornucopia say there are many sites at Chaco which they believe mark solstices, equinoxes, and even lunar events. But they say they haven't had enough time to study them, since most time is spent preserving the 1,000-year-old homes at Chaco from the elements. Ford and Cornucopia say it's quite likely that the Anastasi, like others around the world, paid close attention to the seasons.
The interest that we believe these people had was to be able to track where they were in time. For most societies, keeping time has actually been a sacred activity. For ceremonial reasons, if you're a farmer, certainly the planting season is important. Keeping accurate time of the seasons is really at the heart of many people's ability to survive in the environments they find themselves in.
I don't know of any culture that doesn't somehow formally record solstices, not so much equinoxes, but summer and winter solstices.
Ford explains that we keep time with clocks and calendars, while the Anastasi kept time with places like the Sun Dagger. But there is still a great deal to learn about the Anastasi. It's believed they were an oral society, and G.B. Cornucopia says all that's left to study are the buildings left behind at places like Chaco.
It's like a giant Rorschach test where all of your preconceived notions can get projected out onto this stuff. And so we may never know the final answers.
So it's quite possible that the people gathered for the solstice sunrise at Chaco may very well be interpreting it in a completely incorrect way. It makes you wonder what relics from our society will motivate tourists to stare at a wall 1,000 years from now. This is The Environment Show. Thanks for listening.
This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, energy used to be almost free in Russia, so nobody cared much about conserving it. But times may be changing thanks to rising prices. Is your house or office causing you to get sick? We talk green about indoor air pollution. Hospital waste. There's too much of it, and we can all do something about it. And lightning shows the way home to the Carolina Mountains. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. Russians aren't in the habit of conserving energy. Under the communist system, they paid almost nothing for heat, electricity, and water. Today, their energy system is still in bad shape. It remains amazingly inefficient, wasting natural resources, creating unnecessary pollution, and costing the country much-needed cash. But economic concerns may push the Russians to start saving. Nancy Marshall reports from Moscow.
Most Russians aren't used to turning the lights off as they're leaving a room, but they have started doing that because electricity rates are going up. Water and heat are another matter. They're still fully controlled by the Russian government. The government turns everyone's heat on a designated day in the fall and turns it off in the spring. Russian homes can get hot if there's an early spring and the heat's still on. The only way to turn the heat down is to open a window. Russians don't have individual thermostats, so can't actually control the heat themselves. Water is handled the same way. You pay a set amount for your water, no matter how much you use. All this means wasted natural resources and unnecessary pollution. The Russian government is trying to change the situation, but it's slow going. Russian Prime Minister Viktor Chernomyrdin recently vented his frustration with the slow pace of change, noting that even in new houses, it's impossible to measure how much water and heat are being used. 3 days ago, Muscovites came to me and said meters are being put into new buildings and homes, but they don't work. Chernomyrdin says the meters for water and heating don't work, only the ones for electricity. Can this really be the case? No one here seems the slightest bit put out by this. Don't we care? The few environmental activists in Russia care, among them Edward Gies-Matulin of the Moscow office of Greenpeace. He says Russia now loses 40 to 45% of the energy it produces because of inefficient technology, things like leaky oil and gas pipelines. Gies-Matulin says the government of the former Soviet Union created a centralized, inefficient energy system 30 years ago as former Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev was building scores of bleak, towering apartment blocks that now ring almost every city in Russia. Gies-Matulin says the system has changed very little since then.
When the decision was made, let's say in the 60s during Khrushchev's time, should we construct efficient houses or should we construct cheap and fast? The idea was, the Soviet Union is the biggest country in the world. We have huge amount of natural resources. So let's construct cheap and fast and we don't care about efficiency. You see, the government and the ministries were aiming to extract as much as possible, to broad as much as possible. And nobody was really thinking about efficiency and how efficient to use this energy.
But Gies-Matulin says things are different now. Oil and gas prices have risen in Russia, causing increased interest in conservation, if only to save money. Gies-Matulin says the Russian government has made just a token effort toward encouraging energy conservation through a year-old law that's very weak.
There is a law which was accepted last year, in April last year, about energy efficiency. But basically, this law is really weak. It doesn't make anyone to save energy. It just basically says, it's nice to save. And that's it. And that's why a lot of energy experts have been criticizing this law, that it's not really providing the ways and not really making companies and making the government to save energy.
Gies-Matulin says Russian companies that do want to save energy run into a number of obstacles, including the government's attitude. He claims that politically powerful oil and gas companies are only interested in selling as much of their product as possible and are discouraging energy conservation. Gies-Matulin says these energy companies put pressure on the government, trying to discourage legislation mandating energy-saving measures. Outside of politics, he says Russian businesses face practical obstacles to energy conservation.
Not a lot of companies even know the way how they can save energy, how they can save money, because energy is money, money is energy. And sometimes they have, like, for example, energy managers on the enterprises, which were studying in some colleges, and they know everything about energy. But they never were taught how to save energy. They know how to manage it, but not to save.
Still, Gies Matulin thinks energy conservation is inevitable, mainly because prices are rising and both businesses and residential customers are feeling the pinch and, at the very least, turning lights and appliances off when they're not needed. An unintended benefit of the rising prices could be a cleaner environment. For the Environment Show, I'm Nancy Marshall in Moscow.
We're talking green, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Today we're talking about indoor air pollution, an aspect of the environment that affects all of us, both in our homes and in our workplaces. We want to hear from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN, and I have a couple of experts with me on the line. One is Dr. Linda Ford. She is CEO of the Asthma and Allergy Center in Omaha, Nebraska, and she is president-elect of the American Lung Association. Since 1993, the Lung Association has built 13 healthy houses as part of an experiment to test techniques and products to reduce health risks. And also with me is Nadav Malin, and he is editor of the Environmental Building News publication in Brattleboro, Vermont. And Dr. Ford, let me start with you. We talk about indoor air pollution as an environmental problem, but it's also a health problem. How much of a problem is it really, and how do people know whether they're impacted by it?
Well, it's certainly a big problem. It's what we've done with our indoor air over the last few years, and trying to build more cost-conscious houses and decrease our expenses on heating and air conditioning costs. Air pollution contributes to lung disease, including respiratory infections, asthma, and lung cancer, and claims more than 300,000 lives from lung disease every year in the United States. Lung disease is our third leading cause of death in the United States.
So when we talk about it as a function of indoor air pollution, what is it in indoor air that people need to worry about and that causes these health problems?
Well, even in healthy people, people without any type of lung disease, you have to talk about carbon monoxide and radon. Those are probably our two most concerning areas of concern in healthy people. And people who have asthma, on the other hand, they have to be concerned not only with the carbon monoxide and the radon, but also to environmental allergens in their homes, such as mold spores and house dust mite.
Now, Nadav, my understanding is, though, that, in fact, most of us have had experiences with people putting down carpets that make you sick or whatever. How much of the building environment is responsible for the indoor air pollution problems that causes people health concerns?
Well, to the extent that the air is worse inside the building than it is outside the building, which unfortunately is all too often the case, it is the building environment that's responsible for that. The furnishings, as you mentioned, putting down new carpet, is often a factor initially. New carpets tend to off-gas chemicals that come out of the polymers that the carpets are made out of. And those need to be vented to the outside. Preferably, you want to open up and air a carpet out before having it opened up inside your house, or have the windows wide open and the place well ventilated while the carpet is being installed, and for a good time thereafter.
Well, let me ask you something. What you're suggesting are things you can do to guard against something that you're bringing into your home that has a bad impact on your health. Why bring it in to start with? Isn't there an alternative?
That's a very good question. As a culture, we tend to really love carpets. Carpets are soft and they're comfortable and they bring good colors. But people who have concerns, and some people suffer from what we call multiple chemical sensitivities, which means that any number of chemicals can really set them off, not just in terms of allergies, but really make them completely dysfunctional. Those people really need to stay away from carpets entirely.
Well, again, Dr. Linda Ford from the Asthma and Allergy Center, what does the individual do, or what should they think about in their home and in their workplace to protect themselves from this kind of environmental hazard?
Well, if you're talking about a healthy person without any lung disease, such as asthma or allergic rhinitis, you're talking about the irritants that from the carpet itself. But if you're on, if you have asthma or allergic rhinitis, or we typically call hay fever, it's the house dust mite inside the carpet that can be a problem. And even with the new ones or old carpets, or it doesn't make any difference what the age of the carpet is, you'll have house dust mites in that carpet. So the best thing to do is not to have it at all. To use hardwood floors or some other type of hard surfaces instead of the carpet itself.
Okay, so your advice is stay away from carpets. I'm sure the carpet makers will be knocking down our phones.
But, well, a good compromise is to use throw rugs or area rugs that can be taken out and washed.
That's correct.
Okay, well, let's go to the phones. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We're talking green about indoor air pollution, and I see we have a call from Tom. Tom, you're talking green in the Environment Show.
Yes, this is Tom Kennedy with the National Association of Home Builders Research Center.
Uh-huh, so you know all about this carpet problem.
Well, we've been studying indoor air quality for a few years, and I was wondering if health care professions are seeing changes in lifestyle as a result of being more aware of these type of issues.
Good question. Dr. Ford, what's happening out there?
Not yet, although we're trying to make more people aware of what's happening. However, I have not seen a change in people's lifestyles. They're still using carpet. They're still closing and trying to close off all the ventilation within the home.
Well, again, to get this in perspective, Linda, is this a real problem in the United States? I mean, we've got a lot of environmental problems, a lot of health problems. Where does indoor pollution fit into the scheme of things?
Well, if you think about, there are around 14 million Americans who have asthma. About a third of those are children. Now, we stay inside 90% of our time is indoors. Children, the EPA has estimated that the children stay 1.7 to 2.3 hours per day outside. The rest of the time is inside the home. As adults, we probably even have less of that. So it's the indoor air that's really more of the problem than the outdoor.
Okay, well, let's go back to the phones. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We're talking about indoor air pollution, and I'm talking to John Bauer from Indiana. John, welcome. You're talking green in the Environment Show.
Yeah, I've written several books on healthy construction, and I've always advocated three basic principles, eliminate, separate, and ventilate. I think it's first and foremost important to eliminate pollution sources in a house. And there's certainly some things you can't eliminate, like insulation could be a problem. And for those things, I suggest separating them very well from the living environment. In some cases, that means airtight construction. If the house is tightly constructed, the insulation can't bother you. And thirdly, I recommend ventilating. I think all houses are getting tighter and tighter, and they get less natural air exchange. So they really need mechanical ventilation today.
So as we think about chemical contaminants as opposed to dust and spores and so on, Dr. Ford, what is the thing that people need to be the most concerned about? What's the most prevalent?
I think carbon monoxide.
And
I'd worry more about carbon monoxide than I would some of the other ones.
Really? And that comes from where? Most of us think about automobile exhausts or fireplaces.
Any fuel burning appliances, and make sure that the appliances are ventilated to the outside. You'd be surprised, you know, if people put in their gas appliances, how it's not adequately ventilated. Wood-putting fireplaces and coal and wood stoves, space heaters, those can are potential sources for carbon monoxide.
Now, John Bauer, you're still on
the
Healthy House Institute, which you're involved with. What do you folks say about carbon monoxide, and what should the homeowner worry about?
Carbon monoxide is probably the most deadly pollutant that people are routinely encountering. And it kills several hundred people in the U.S. every year. The good news is that, you know, we experience low levels a lot of the time that don't kill us, but the bad news is those low levels can cause flu-like symptoms. And I've seen medical reports that have stated that a quarter of the people reporting they had the flu actually had low-level carbon monoxide poisoning.
And the short-term solution to that, I guess, is to open the window.
Well, that's a very short-term solution. You know, the problem is when you burn anything, whether it's natural gas or oil or wood or candles or incense, you're getting combustion byproducts. And carbon monoxide is a combustion byproduct, and it can enter the house if you have like an unvented fireplace or space heater, but it also enters the house very commonly because chimneys don't function like they're supposed to. You know, those combustion byproducts are supposed to go up the flue and out of the house because, you know, they're usually warm and warm air rises. But in many houses, the indoor air can become depressurized. You know, you imagine blowing air out with a clothes dryer or a range hood or something. An equal volume of air has got to come in somewhere else, and it often comes down the chimney.
So you're sucking it right back in again.
Exactly. Yeah. And this is quite common. It probably happens at some time or another in half the houses out there.
Okay. Well, John, thanks for your call. And Nadav, let me ask you whether the environmental building news has... Is this an issue that you've covered and worked on, either the detection of carbon monoxide or things that need to be done?
It has. In fact, we wrote several reviews of some of the carbon monoxide detectors that were out a few years ago. And unfortunately, some of them got a bit of a bad rep. Some of the early models tended to go off at the wrong times, or they were malfunctioning occasionally.
For those of us that haven't seen these things, is this something like a smoke detector?
It looks exactly like a smoke detector.
A gadget with a battery that you stick on the roof or under your bed or something?
That's exactly it. You mount it on a wall or ceiling, and it looks a lot like a smoke detector and works with a battery in a similar way.
Now, we've just got a little bit of time left. I know that a while ago the EPA started talking about radon in a great length. Dr. Ford, how much of a problem is this? What does it do to people? Do they need to be concerned about it?
It's another colorless, odorless gas, and you can't tell if it's in your home until you get a detector on that. It occurs naturally in the soil and in rock, and it can be a leading cause of some of our lung cancers. In fact, it's only second to cigarette smoke as far as the cause of lung cancer.
Really? I remember when it was first talked about, everybody said this was the ideal target for EPA because no industry was involved and no jobs would be lost because it came from the earth.
It does come from the earth, and it's really not the radon, but it's really a component called the radon daughters, or a breakdown product of radon, that gives us our problem. And it comes up through the ground, through the basement, cracks in basement floors or in the walls or foundation. And
so quickly, in our moments remaining, what does the homeowner do to find out whether this is a problem for them?
They're a short-term and long-term test. The short-term, it means less than 90 days. And it should be the kit, if you get a short-term kit, should be labeled that it meets the EPA requirements. Same thing with the long-term test, which would be over 90 days. The long-term test is more accurate for us.
So you can get a kit and test your home yourself.
You sure can.
And that sounds like a good idea.
I'd like to make the point that insulation is a good thing. It reduces the environmental pollution outside if we burn less fuels to heat our houses. And it's important to insulate well and ventilate well, as opposed to leaving houses intentionally uninsulated or leaky, which isn't a very reliable way.
Good point. All right. I'm afraid our time is up. We've been talking about indoor air pollution, and my guests have been Dr. Linda Ford, CEO of the Asthma and Allergy Center in Omaha, Nebraska, and she is president-elect of the American Lung Association. Also with us has been Nadav Malin. He is editor of Environmental Building News in Brattleboro, Vermont. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We'd like to hear from you. I'm your host, Peter Burley. While environmental conditions like indoor air affect our health care system, and hospitals in particular, affect the environment. Specifically, hospitals generate huge amounts of waste. About 85% is plain ordinary trash, and 10% is biohazardous waste, sometimes called red bag waste. This goes all the way from equipment and supplies used in surgery to body parts. The remaining 5% is hazardous waste, which includes toxic chemicals like mercury. Holly Shaner is the waste specialist at Fletcher Allen Healthcare in Burlington, Vermont, and the author of various books on hospital waste. She says that incineration has been the method of choice to get rid of biomedical waste, but that 90% of it could be disposed of with alternative technologies such as those that use steam and microwave. This would eliminate problems associated with incineration. Most importantly, better segregation of waste at medical facilities could reduce incineration and cost. She says too often she's seen pizza boxes and plastic soda bottles in the biomedical waste stream. In her opinion,
the majority of hospital administrators are not far enough along in waste management and pollution prevention, and the ongoing reorganization of healthcare and the trend to look for outside companies to perform services like housekeeping is making things worse.
We're so stressed out now in healthcare with mergers and downsizing and rapid evolution of care, and there's just, you know, managed care and such a chaos going on that waste is really not on the radar screen in healthcare. You know, we're outsourcing critical functions like housekeeping and food services and all these things, and the folks who would be handling the waste may not necessarily even have the skills to do it.
One thing that is high on the radar screen is cost.
Mm-hmm.
If one did a better job at handling waste, does that have to increase cost?
No, it does not. In fact, many of the hospitals that I've worked with in my consulting practice are saving $1 million a year, $500,000 a year by better management. Segregating waste so that you minimize the amount that's in the biohazard category and still be in full compliance saves a lot of money. To dispose of red bag or biohazard waste is about 10 times the cost of solid waste. And then hazardous waste, which would be things like batteries and mercury and some of those other chemical solvents, I mean, that's like $1 to $6 a pound or more. It's even more costly. So there's a tremendous economic incentive for healthcare facilities, hospitals, to manage their waste, save money, but, you know, through segregation.
She says more training is necessary, so waste and pollution prevention is a concern of everybody in the healthcare business.
I think it's really critical that healthcare facilities, healthcare organizations, make it mandatory that all staff get some type of environmental education specific to waste, around waste segregation, because it is not part of the curriculum. So just like they have mandatory requirements for CPR and fire code and confidentiality, that every employee must take those mandatories every year, we need to add waste management to the mandatories annually, so that every employee, whether they're cutting open hearts or scrubbing toilets, you know, every employee working in a healthcare facility is very clear about what waste goes where. And also that we do have some mandatory education for the folks involved with procurement, so that the people bringing the products into the organization are very clear about, you know, what is the chemical composition of the materials they're bringing in, how are they going to be disposed, what's the cost, and what's the environmental impact. So those are a couple things I would throw in.
Unlike some environmental problems that we can't do much about, Shaner says we all can help solve this one. The place to start is to ask your local hospital or your doctor who is affiliated with it, what's being done to segregate waste? What's being done to reduce it, to screen incoming supplies, and to train the entire facility staff? Without a push from the community, she fears that better management of waste is something health facilities just won't get around to. Summer is here, and that means hot days broken up here and there by a passing thunderstorm. Sometimes lightning is so bright, the sky lights up like a giant camera flash. Southern Rail is a bluegrass band with roots in the Southern Appalachians. Their 1993 release is entitled Carolina Lightning. It explains how the highway to their home lights up.
Light my way down the highway, though the rain is pouring down. Come the morning, I'll be home in the mountains that I love. 6:35 in the evening, and the sky is black and gray, caressing the tops of the mountains. All these clouds are here to stay. Howling winds through the valley shake the trees against the sky. It can't shake the power that called me to keep rolling down the road. pouring down. I see my foolish life flash before me. All the roads that I've traveled, all the hills that I've climbed, and I wonder why I ever went away. In an hour I'll be coming home to stay. Coming home to stay. North Carolina lightning, silver threads across the sky. Show me the way to tomorrow as my home is drawing nigh. Don't let me ever think of leaving. Scare me home if I try. Come the morning I'll be home in the mountains that I love. Never think of leaving. Scare me home if I try. Come the morning I'll be home in the mountains that I love. My Carolina home. My Carolina home.
Southern Rail with their song Carolina Lightning off their 1993 release of the same name. May lightning light your way home as well. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 390. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer, Thomas Lally is producer, and Stephanie Goichman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Packard Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for The Environment Show.